Hey, everybody. Dave Hodges here, host of The Common Sense Show. We are the show that is freeing America, one enslaved mind at a time. And we have a terrific show for you today. We have Jim Jenkins with us, and he is the last remaining person that was at the JFK autopsy. And as all of you know out there, I've got a renewed interest in JFK. I've been on this for 40 years. But you know that I've taken a renewed interest because I fear for former President Trump's safety. And I think we have good reason to fear. And I've started to look back for parallels. And I'm reopening my interest in this case. And here we have a chance to talk to somebody who was actually at the autopsy, filled with massive controversy. And I cannot wait to get to the interview with Jim. But first, we got to take care of a little business. First of all, we have a TV show. And you all know that. TheCommonSenseShow.tv, and that's where you go to sign up. We have a great price in place right now until September 1st, less than $3 a month. You can get access to our panel of experts, our in-depth interviews that we really take the form of documentaries, and we'd encourage you to sign up before the 1st. Take advantage of this great price break. Go to TheCommonSenseShow.tv. Also, storable food. Ladies and gentlemen, let me tell you, I'm really worried about the food supply. The farmers are filling my ears every day with the latest that's going on, and it's not good. And now we're facing a railroad strike on September 16th, and that's when federal arbitration ends and the strike could continue or actually commence. And so, ladies and gentlemen, get your storable food now. All the details are at preparewithdave.com. And then finally, if we're going to suffer, let's suffer in comfort. Mike Lindell contacted me. MyPillow.com, and everything is half price for our audience. That's right, Mike Lindell, half price, MyPillow.com/Hodges, MyPillow.com/Hodges, and the coupon code is also Hodges. So that takes care of our business for the show. Jim Jenkins was born in 1942, joined the Navy, and I think really more to the point of our interview, he assisted Humes and Boswell in the autopsy of JFK, and that autopsy is filled with so much controversy. So here we have an eyewitness to help us straighten out truth from fiction. Jim, welcome to the show. I'm so glad you could join us.
Thank you.
Well, Jim, how was it that you ended up being assigned to the autopsy? I mean, that's quite a detail.
I was in school at the clinical laboratory and blood banking school at Bethesda. And one of my duties as being in the Navy, I always had duty. My duty was to assist the residents in doing autopsies. And that happened to be my duty night.
Well, that was quite a night to be on. So am I wrong in assuming then that they didn't go out and hand select the most experienced people? Because I know at the time you were only 21 years of age.
Yeah, Paul and I were both students, and it just fell on our duty night.
My goodness gracious. What? I mean, you must have been in absolute shock. Here the president is killed, which horrified the nation. And all of a sudden, you're standing before his body helping with an autopsy. What was that like?
Well, actually, to me, it was just, it was intense, of course, because, you know, Paul and I were second-class hospital corpsmen, and everyone in there were at least, you know, commanders or above, and civilians. Which I assume the civilians were mostly Secret Service. And then, of course, I know there were two FBI agents. It was a very tense atmosphere for several reasons.
Yeah. Well, give us... Before we jump into that, let me bring in something that's not on our question list here that I'm going to go through with you. But I just wanted to ask you, were you familiar with the photographer of the autopsy, Lieutenant Pitzer?
I know who he was. Lieutenant Pitzer, he was a believe he was lieutenant commander. He He was not at the autopsy. The photographer, they were actually two. One was a Navy student, and the other one was a civilian. And you know, he was in charge of the photography school there.
Okay, well, what I'll tell you what ran. There was a series that ran on A&E with Bill Curtis. I think it was a 6-episode series on the men who killed Kennedy. And one of the things they covered was Lieutenant Pitzer being the photographer, and then he bragged to his friends he was going to retire and he was going to go on the Tonight Show and expose the fraud of the autopsy, and that they believed that he was murdered because of the unusual circumstances of his death, like a left-handed man shooting himself in the head with his right hand and so forth. And so you're saying he wasn't even at the autopsy?
No.
Okay.
What I heard from Dennis David. Dennis David was the first-class hospital corpsman that was in charge of the detail that actually brought the president's body into the morgue. Dennis and Pitzer were actually good friends. They played bridge together at lunchtime and breaks and that type of stuff. So he knew him really well. And he had told me, and he told, of course, others too, that he had seen a film of JFK's autopsy that Pitzer was editing and had shown it to him. We didn't take any film that night other than photographs. And, you know, of course, there's so much of that out there that I really don't, I try not to make any judgments or so forth.
I don't really know
any real details about the assassination other than the morgue, what we did in the morgue.
Well, if Pitzer wasn't there, I think that puts to rest that story. Nothing like you were at the scene and say he wasn't there. Well, then he wasn't there, and that kind of discredits part of that series. When we look at the autopsy team and they brought the body in, who was in charge, in your opinion? Was it the military or was it the people in civilian uniforms?
Well, actually, the person who was in charge of the autopsy itself was Dr. Humes.
Okay.
But he was being directed by someone in the gallery that kept calling him back to the gallery. This individual was one of the, I don't know if he was one of the admirals or one of the generals. I had been told that he was Admiral Berkeley, who was the physician, personal physician for the president. But I later, in talking to another individual, I found that Dr. Berkeley at that time was in civilian clothes. And there was an individual that kept coming into the morgue and talking to this general.
Okay.
That was in civilian clothes. So it may have been Berkeley then.
That was also covered, The Men Who Killed Kennedy, and was also in the JFK movie with Oliver Stone. I don't know if you saw that movie or not.
No, I haven't seen it.
Okay, but they actually had, they tried to cloud this in mystery, like this mysterious person in civilian clothes was directing the people in the autopsy. And you're saying there's at least some truth in that.
Yes, there is. That was Dr. Berkeley.
Okay, all right. And so we know who the person was. Very good. That's more information than I've ever had on this. When JFK's body left Dealey Plaza and went to Bethesda, that's the official narrative. Can you speak to the number of caskets, and did the body really arrive, as everybody said? Or there's so much controversy there. Was the president operated on ahead of time? Can you shed some light on all this?
Well, what I know is that the body came in a what I call the shipping casket, pretty much the same as you see in the films with bodies coming in off of the being picked up at the airport, that type of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
It came in, and it was brought into the morgue proper by civilians, or by people in suits, and there was a couple of military people with him. And then the body was removed from that. I started going over, but Paul and I were supposedly the people who were assisting everybody, but it came in and everything was there. They placed it on the floor of the morgue, and there were so many people there that I just stayed back, and Paul went over and helped remove the body, and they put it on the table in front of me.
Okay, and so was there a controversy in your mind about did the president make an uninterrupted trip to the autopsy?
Well, I remember the wounds that we saw at autopsy, and then sometime later I had an opportunity to talk to a couple of people from Parkland in Dallas, Dr. McClellan and Audrey Bell. And I believe there was another physician there. And their description of the wounds and what we saw at the autopsy they didn't correlate very well.
Yeah, you're talking about Dr. McClellan, who actually worked on the president at Parkland Hospital, correct?
Right.
Okay.
Right. And Audrey Bell was in charge of the emergency room.
Yes, I'm familiar with that story as well, too. You know what's interesting is when they had the Warren Commission, why they wouldn't call Dr. McClellan to testify. I don't know if you're aware of that, but don't you find that odd that the first doctor on the scene would not be called to testify as to what he saw?
Well, there are a lot of other, quote, questions.
Yes, sir.
About the Warren Commission.
Yes, there are. But that's a big one in my mind.
Yeah, I think that was probably intentional.
Yeah, I think it is too, and it's I don't know. America was very trusting in 1963, and I think the Warren Commission got away with things that they wouldn't get away with today, or with all the social media. At least I'd like to think that. When we look at the difference in the wounds. Can you speak specifically to them? Like, the controversy was Oswald shooting Kennedy and the kill shot hit the back of the head, as opposed to the shot that might have been fired from the grassy knoll that caused the president's head to go back into the left. So, did the head wound? Can you address that as to what you understand?
Well, I will tell you what I saw. I saw a wound in the right temple. There's just a little bit in front of the ear, right in the hairline. And that wound was discovered by Dr. Fink. And Dr. Fink and Dr. Humes were examining it. And then Dr. Humes was called over to the gallery. He came back to the table. And he told Dr. Think, well, we need to get on the back wound in the back of the head. And they never went back to that wound. That wound was about the size of the end of your little finger, and it had gray in borders. And Dr. Fink had speculated that maybe that the gray in border had come from a bullet. But they never went back to it at all during the autopsy. It was never examined again. As a matter of fact, when the brain was removed, and they did a coronal suture down from the wounds, or actually from an extended wound from the back wound to toward the front, which looked as if it might have been surgically it was a wound that ran from the top of the back wound forward almost to the frontal bone, and it was composed of a lot of little rents and tears that looked like they had been surgically connected to make one long incision. And it was, that was what prompted Dr. Humes to ask the gallery, had they done any surgery in Parkland?
Oh, my gosh. And they said, he asked that question, actually said that?
Yes, he did.
Oh, my gosh. That's huge.
And we were told that, no, we didn't. And then the other wound that was kind of suspicious was a throat wound. And we were told that the throat wound was a tracheotomy, don't bother with it. And we virtually didn't bother with it. But it was, I would say it was probably 6-7 centimeters, maybe 2.5 inches wide. And I'd never seen a tracheotomy that was horizontal as opposed to perpendicular. And I have never seen one since. And it didn't make sense that it would be done that way for the simple reason that it would have involved the wings of the thyroid, the lower wings of the thyroid. But anyway, we never examined it. It was one of the big controversies after the Warren Commission and the official autopsy.
Well, yeah. Geez, this is, I did not know. I know there's controversy about the angle of the direction of the wound in the throat and the head. I want to go back to the head wound just for a second here. When you looked at the head wound at the temple just above the right ear, would it be your judgment that that was an entrance wound as opposed to an exit wound?
I couldn't make that decision. That would have had to have been made from the inside of the cranium.
Yeah, and the other problem with that too, Jim, is that if the brain had been surgically altered, as the question was raised in the autopsy, then you wouldn't be able to tell anyway. But I know, I'll tell you what McClellan said. I mean, I read right from his testimony to, I forget who he gave the interview to, but he said that the back of the president's skull had an evulsed cavity that you could literally stick your fist into. And so that would suggest that wound in the temple going backwards would have been that evulsed hole that McClellan said he saw.
Yeah. And he did, the wound in the back, there were, we really couldn't tell any of the borders of it and so forth until we retracted the scalp from the bone, from the skull. And during that retraction, some of the bone that was adhered to the scalp fell into the cavity. But the wound itself was more in line. I mean, once we saw the wound, actually in the skull itself, it was more in line with what Parkland had said than with what was in the autopsy report. The autopsy report was, I think Humes put it at 13 centimeters, which would have been somewhere around 5-6 inches, but he didn't say how he measured. And then also in one of the testimonies that I read from Boswell, he said it was 19 centimeters. So I really don't know how they were measuring it. Were they measuring it from the bottom of it to the top, or from one side to the bottom side, that type of thing? That was one of the things that I saw in the autopsy report that was a big question.
Man, that's huge. This is huge information. I mean, this, you know, Jim, you don't have to be a pathologist or have the knowledge you do to see a cover up here. They were clearly trying to change how they could explain away the assassination from coming from the 6th floor of the book depository.
Well, I think the other thing that was in the autopsy report was the entrance wound in the back of the head. There are a lot of things about that don't really add up. First of all, if the description was, if I remember correctly, it was to the right side, approximately an inch or maybe an inch and a half from the occipital protuberance. And it changed. Boswell, they changed it. It would go from below the occipital protuberance to lateral with the occipital protuberance and so forth. But anyway, I think what they did is when they put it in the autopsy report, they didn't realize that position was actually almost right in the middle of the head wound where the bone and the tissue were missing. And I think they later on, I read something, I don't remember where it was, as far as the testimony said that later on at the end of the autopsy, there was a large piece of bone that came in, and they determined that was an interest wound by x-raying the large piece of bone.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
I never saw a large piece of bone. I saw some small pieces of bone and metal that came in a small zip tie bag. Was kind of like our clear plastic bag with a zip tie on the top of it. It came in, but it only had fragments that were in the millimeters. Last time I remember seeing it, it was placed on the autopsy table down by the right ear. And I don't know what happened to that. At the end of the autopsy, Paul and I were told to go to Captain Stover's office, and they gave us orders not to discuss it with anyone. And then when I went back to the morgue to make sure everything was clean and so forth, the brain was gone. All of the specimens were gone. And I don't remember ever seeing that little bag again.
Well, the allegations are, I know Cyril Wecht, the noted pathologist, said the brain ended up missing. So is that your contention too?
I know Cyril Wecht. He and I have talked a lot. My contention is the brain was removed from the cranium by Dr. Humes. And he actually did that. He did, he said he did a skull cap, but he did not. All he did was extend some wounds. The wound that went forward, he started there and went down, made an incision down almost to the tragus of the ear, which is a little deal in the middle of your ear. And then you could lay the skull open at that time because there were two fractures. There was a high fracture, major fracture in the skull, and one right above the ear. And the skull was actually fragmented and being held together by the scalp, and you could actually move it around with your fingers or with your hands.
Yeah, yeah, that's.
And what he did was they laid it open and took the brain out. There are a lot of things that will happen with that. Was the fact is that I remember and understand I'm standing at the shoulder of the president, and Dr. Fink is to my left at the head of the table, and Dr. Humes is to his left, and then Dr. Boswell's across the table from me. And Dr. I could hear all of the conversations and so forth that were going on. I had to be able to do that because when they asked me to do something or need something, it was my duty to get it. But anyway, getting back to the brain, he actually laid the side of the head open and took the brain out that way.
Ooh.
Now, during the time he was removing the brain, he kind of uttered this thing to himself, like, well, the damn thing fell out my hand. Well, I really didn't think too much of that. I thought, well, maybe the fragments and bullet and so forth has severed the brain stem. And anyway, he took the brain out, handed it to Dr. Boswell, and Dr. Boswell motioned for me to follow him. And we went over to what we call the brain bucket. It was a stainless steel bucket with formalin in it. And we usually put a gauze sling over it. And we would take the brain and take it up and turn it upside down and infuse it. And then toward the end of the autopsy, we put it in the bucket. But there were some unusual things that I noticed that struck me as being a little being odd. First of all, the brain, when Dr. Humes gave it to Dr. Boswell, it looked small to me. And the other thing that I noticed was the fact is that the convolutions of the brain, they were flat. Where instead of being the gray that we normally saw at autopsy, they were kind of a shiny pale, a little bit paler than that. And that was the first thing I noticed. When we got to the bucket, I was the coleman, so I got down on my knees, and Dr. Boswell handed me the brain. I turned it upside down to infuse, and I was having difficulty getting the needles into the carotids, internal carotids, because they were actually retracted and shriveled a little bit. And I also looked at the brainstem. The brainstem had been cut. It actually had been surgically cut, but it was a little unusual in the fact that it looked like it surgically cut, like it had been cut from one side and then completed from the other side. It looked, kind of like when you cut something then from both sides and meet in the middle, it's always a little, one's a little higher.
Well, that speaks to the possible manipulation before you saw the brain. In other words, pre-surgery done. You know, let me give this to you. And please just accept this as a hypothesis, but I'm confident in what I'm telling you. Jim Mars and I, Jim helped Oliver Stone with the script for the movie JFK. Jim Mars and I researched, and this is more Jim's credit. He found two people, and one of these people was actually interviewed by Bill Curtis on A&E, and they both said the same thing. One was in witness protection. He spoke on anonymity. The other was completely open. His name was Christian David. They identified the real assassin on the grassy knoll, and they said he used a hollow point bullet, and it was his shot that struck the president from the right front and made his head go back into the left. And both men, independently, continents apart, told the same story. Would that possibly explain the use of a hollow point bullet, which amasses a huge path through the brain? Could that explain some of the anomalies you're describing?
I don't believe that it could, because the damage to the brain that I actually put in to that I actually infused, the damage was in the right area. It was the anterior occipital parietal area.
Right.
But it wasn't as extensive as you would have expected from the damage that was in the skull, in the head wound. And it certainly wasn't as extensive as they indicated in the autopsy, the official autopsy. There is no lacerations into the sinuses or anything of that nature that I noticed, because if I had it, I wouldn't have been able to, well, there'd been no reason to infuse the brain, because, you know, if the damage had been as extensive as they said, then the infusion would not have remained in the skull. It would just have run out of the wound.
So what you're telling me, there's a huge discrepancy here, an unexplained discrepancy that might be explained by physical manipulation.
Well, I think I've worked with a neurologist that is interested in this. His primary interest is in actually in the X-rays and somewhat in the brain. And I think that he has actually seen the photos in the archives, which I've not been allowed to do. And, you know, from his description and so forth, the brain was asymmetrical, which, I mean, it could have been the bullet, you know, the pressure from the bullet passing through could have created problems with that. But I feel like that there's probably enough evidence to, at least for me, to believe that the brain that we had at autopsy, we took at autopsy, was not the president's brain.
Oh, my gosh, that's a heck of a charge. Wow. That's a heck of a charge. A lot of people believe that the brain at the autopsy was surgically altered to cover up directionality and type of bullet and so forth. But you're coming at this as entirely differently. I want to go back to something you just said, because I don't want to gloss over this. You're at the autopsy. You are an expert for historical purposes. Why wouldn't they let you see the photos at the autopsy, or excuse me, autopsy at the archives, when they let other people see it?
I'm not a physician, and what happens was, when all of the photographs and X-rays and so forth were actually finally given to the archives, they were given under a gift of trust or something like that, and the Kennedy family set up, along with, well, their lawyer and the lawyer for the government, they set up this trust type thing, and they set the parameters for who could or who could not see the who would be allowed in and who were not, was not allowed in. And one of the criteria was to be a physician, and the other was to be a well-known published physician.
Oh my gosh.
And,
so shouldn't this be open? Shouldn't this be open? This is like the 9/11 cover up, where the evidence from 9/11 is in the National Archives, not National Archives, but in Hangar 17 at JFK Airport, and no one can see it. Here, you're looking at the same thing. Shouldn't this stuff be available to the public? I mean, we're almost 60 years past the date.
I've always thought it should be available to the public.
Yeah, we're total agreement there, Jim, because I'm tired of the government treating us like little children and with our tax money deciding what we can and cannot see. And to me, that just speaks more to a cover-up. If they don't want us to think there's a cover-up, then don't act like you're doing a cover-up.
One of the things, you know, one of the things that that indicates that is that, you know, Paul and I, our names were sequestered by Johnson for 50 years. In other words, no one was to know who we were for 50 years. And, you know, it wasn't until after the House Select Committee, which I testified for.
Yeah, or actually, Jim, let's not skip over that. I want you to tell this, but a lot of people in our audience may not know who the House Select Committee was. I believe it was 1977, the second assassination investigation by Congress.
It was.
Yes, okay. So now that we got that out of the way, and let me ask you this too. Were you prevented from publicly talking about this by a national security order?
Oh, I had orders from the Secretary of the Navy and the Secretary of Defense.
You know, I don't know if the audience is grasping this. We're getting history from a gentleman here who was at the autopsy of the president. He's giving you all the anomalies with exquisite medical detail, and yet he's told for, sounds like, 50 years, he couldn't speak about it. This is real history, Jim. This is incredible. Well, I'm sorry. Well, go ahead and continue, because you said you testified at the House Select Committee on Assassination in 1977.
Yeah, I did. They came and I did a deposition with them. And, of course, after that, it was public information as to who Paul and I were at that time. And, you know, people started coming in and wanting to do interviews. And at that time, I was in graduate school in pathology. And my focus was on other things than the assassination.
Were you afraid of retribution if you spoke out, revenge from certain people?
I was leery. I did the first interview with David Lipton, and it was kind of a concerning type thing. Because at that time I lived, I was in Texas and San Antonio, and we lived at Canyon Lake, which was about 30 miles out in the country. And, I talked to David. He had, called me. I told him I really wasn't interested. And then Paul called me and told me that he was a nice guy. Go ahead and talk to him. So I agreed to do that, and I thought we were just going to have an interview. And, he would show up, maybe take the interview or whatever. But he showed up with an entourage. And I was leery because, like I said before, I was living on the lake and really didn't have a lot of people around, and I was concerned about that interview, and that was about the time that there was all the information things that were getting out about the people that were dying and
yes,
from the serious type of things.
Yeah, over 300 deaths attributed to some connection with the Kennedy assassination. You were right to be leery. When was it that you felt comfortable speaking out like you are right now with us in our audience? What year was that, and what led to your ability to speak out in your mind?
Well, I guess I really got involved in this. I've done interviews with Livingstone Harry and William Law. And William, I'd known him for 20 something years and over. And, you know, he kept wanting me to get involved in it, and so forth. And finally, I reluctantly went to the 50th anniversary. And it was kind of a telling thing for me. I had I was going to sit with William and during his presentation and so forth. And the question, well, I got, we came up on the stage, they introduced William, and then William handed me the microphone and I started taking questions. And it was like, you know, we had a 55-minute window there, and then the guy that was next gave up his window, and then we had to go to the dinner, and then I agreed to go back after the dinner and take questions from whomever wanted to come. And so I went back after the dinner, and we finally broke it up about 3 o'clock in the morning. Well, that impressed upon me the interest that the people had, because I talked with people from, especially the Scandinavian countries, from Australia, Japan, and other countries. And I began to realize that, you know, there was an interest in this, and it wasn't just a lot of people writing books and that type of stuff. And so I met the neurologist and Dr. Mankin, and we were interested. It got me really interested in, you know, and I kind of felt a little guilty about all the years that I wouldn't get involved in it. But anyway, I talked with him. I began to work with the neurologist, and I actually went to the university where he was teaching and so forth, and attended a conference there with his with their neurology and X-ray department. And after that, William had always wanted me to write a book. So I decided, well, okay, I'll write a book. And I guess in 3 years after that I had finished the book, and it was published several years ago.
And tell the audience, what's the name of the book?
It's Cold Shoulder of History.
And can people still get that book today?
Yes. It can be bought from Amazon.
Okay.
And then the publisher, of course, I don't really know what's going on with that. The contract is over. But I think he's also has some inventory. And at this point in time, you know, as long as it's in print, which it is, then the publisher's allowed to sell it. So,
well, we'll put this interview up on our website at thecommonsenseshow.com, and we'll put a link in to where people can order the book, because I'm sure for a lot of the people in my age group, you know, I was in elementary school when JFK was assassinated, and, you know, we never forget. We don't believe the government. This is amazing. Hey, what year did you finally start to talk to that neurologist and went public? Can you give me that year?
Yeah, it was the 50th anniversary, so it would have been
2013? 23. Yeah, it's interesting.
It would have been 23.
Yeah. Yeah, okay. All right.
2000.
You and I share a commonality. My dad was, he retired from the Navy 6 months early, and they put him on special assignment. And he worked reverse engineering theoretical physics of German scientists in Colorado. And that's where I grew up. And he did that work for 8 years. And he told me about it before he died in 1984, 85. Over a 2-year period, says, but you cannot tell anybody publicly because they'll take my pensions away from your mom when I'm gone. And he was telling me this when he was terminal. So I understand the pressure that comes to bear. And when my mom passed away in 2011, you know, I've got a free license now to talk about this. So I understand exactly where you're coming from and why you waited so long to come out. And also, too, people were being killed. I completely understand the caution. I would have been cautious, too.
Well, I guess I was more concerned about my family than,
sure,
than myself. You know,
you should have been.
But
let me ask you a question. I want to take a 30,000 foot view for a second. Okay, because this is a lifetime event for you. And we rise above the whole Kennedy assassination. And you're looking back on this now. And do you have any ideas on, one, why he was killed, and two, possibly who could have done it? What do you tell yourself about those questions?
Well, I really, you know, during all of this and during the time that I was writing the book, and since the first interview that I ever did, I have people that send me all kinds of books, newspaper clippings and things of that nature. I've been asked before that I think that Oswald killed Kennedy. If all I can say is if Oswald was in the book depository, if he shot at Kennedy, and if he hit Kennedy from behind, the wound that was in the back, and I mean the back, not in the neck, it was in the back, was not life-threatening. I mean, it was life-threatening if it had not been attended to, but it never entered the pleural cavity. And it didn't go, in order for it to have taken the trajectory that was described in the autopsy, it would have had to have gone in. It would have had to make almost a 45 degree turn upward, go up, and then make another 90 degree turn and come out the neck.
Hello, magic bullet. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and that was not. Now, what struck me was during the autopsy report included everything that would have been found and looked at if the back wound had actually exited in the neck. And in my book, I show where the entrance was. You know, how far below the neck wound that it was.
Sure.
And the other thing about it, that wound, when it was probed downward toward the caudal or the feet of the downward and not upward. And it was a very short wound. In other words, it, you know, Humes could probe it with his little finger.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
And I could see, by that time, Dr. Boswell and I had all the organs out of the body. And I could see the imprint of it, of the probe that they used to begin with, and then the imprint of his finger on the outside of the pleura, which is the lining of the chest cavity.
Mm-hmm.
It never entered the chest. And the bruise that they talk about on the lungs, on the apex of the lungs, it was not where they said it was. It was at the apex, right above the apex of the middle lobe, which is the top of the middle lobe, just as the upper lobe starts.
Right. Okay.
And
I think we've got that picture. That is so clear, so discrepant from what they tried to sell to us. I mean, it's no question. Now that we're going forward, do you think, having lived through this period, do you think the controversy is so great regarding Kennedy that an establishment group would not dare assassinate a future president or a current president or a past president like Donald Trump? What's your opinion on that? You think Kennedy's a standalone event?
No. No. I don't. My opinion is totally my opinion is that the Kennedy assassination for me was a turning point as far as my trust in politics and the government. Prior to that, I really never had much of a thought one way or the other about, you know, the government and so forth. I came from a little southern area town, so forth, and made jokes about John Bell Williams being governor of Mississippi, and they voted for him because he only had one arm and he couldn't fill both pockets, those type of things. But I think that this was the beginning of what we are seeing the fruition of today.
I could not agree with you more. The perpetrators of the assassination may be dead and gone, but their descendants are carrying on in very like fashion.
I think you're true. I agree. You know, I think people need to stop and think, who were the two people who politically gained from this? And, you know, and why would a president of the United States sequester all of the obvious evidence? And then people also need to realize there's never been a legal investigation into this, only a political hearing. And several political hearings, and they've all come out supporting as much as they could get away with the Warren Commission.
Yeah, and the Warren Commission—it's been so discredited. You're so right on the money with this. I've got to ask you a factual question here, and you may not have any knowledge of this, but one of the things that Jim Mars discovered, and also Bill Curtis in that series, The Men Who Killed Kennedy, they maintain that Humes and Boswell, the two autopsy doctors, were ordered to burn their notes from the autopsy. Do you know anything about that?
I don't know if they were ordered to. I know that Humes said that he burned the initial notes because it had blood on it. But that doesn't really, that's really not a valid reason, because the face sheet, which everyone sees, which is the sheet that we put, you know, initially when we open the body, when we unwrap the body, we put all the scars and distinguishing characteristics of the body onto the sheet. It's actually a drawing of a body, and Boswell and I did that. I wrote it down. Boswell dictated what to write, but I don't know. There are a lot of things.
Yeah.
In the caskets, I know that there was a casket in the anteroom up against the coal box.
We're almost out of time. So as opposed to the body bag that you had the president in, you saw a casket. And this is consistent with people at Parkland Hospital when the Secret Service forcibly took the body away, and they termed in terms of how they packed the president. Yeah, this is so right on the money with what I know. We're flat out of time. Ladies and gentlemen, we've been talking to History Revisited firsthand with James Curtis Jenkins, author of the book. Jim, I'm sorry, the title just disappeared from my screen. Can you give that to us?
Yes. at Cold Shoulder of History.
At the Cold Shoulder of History, available on Amazon,
yes.
And we'll publish the link on our website. Jim, this has been a fantastic interview. Thank you so much for answering these questions and being brave enough to come forward. God bless you.